When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Of the Elise Glink Show. I'm Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make really smart choices about your financial life. But first, here's my Glinkonomics report for the week. If you're a renter, I sure hope you've been saving up for a down payment. You may soon find it's cheaper to own than rent. According to Zillow, rent prices are increasing at a faster clip than home values for the first time since April of 2013. That calculation is based on Zillow's rental price data and the rate of change they're seeing nationwide in their proprietary Zestimate values. Zillow's analysis showed rents increased by 4% year-over-year in April, while home values only increased by 3% over the same period. Historically, by the way, home prices should appreciate at just over the rate of inflation. So the only surprise here is that home prices are moving the way they're supposed to at the moment. But life is getting more expensive for renters who are already spending on average 30% of their income on their homes compared to only 15% for homeowners. That is a huge chunk of gross annual income, which is how that number is actually calculated. If you look at take-home pay, renters are spending about 50% of their take-home cash on a rental payment. Ouch. So if you're a renter with good credit and there's any way at all for you to scrape together a down payment, you'll save money in the long run if you find a home in your price range that meets your living needs and you take out a loan and you actually go ahead and buy it. Okay, let's get on with the rest of today's show. I've got two guests with me this week and a whole bunch of other information for you. I start off by talking with Darren Bloomquist. He's vice president of Realty Track, and we're talking about the April foreclosure numbers, which saw a mini spike in activity. We're actually going to do a two-part interview with Darren, and the second part, we're going to talk about the new new construction residential sales numbers. There are a lot of interesting statistics from April, and I don't think I'm giving anything away by telling you that the numbers look the best for new construction than they have looked in 7 years. So I think this is going to be a super interesting discussion leading into the summer home buying season. Next, I'll speak with Mary Comerio, who is a professor of architecture at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School. She's written extensively about specialized insurance for natural disasters. And hello, it's June 1st next week. And of course, that just means hurricane season. So we're going to discuss the complexities and challenges homeowners face when looking for coverages in various parts of the country where either hurricanes or earthquakes or other natural disasters are common. And a shout out right now to our listeners in Texas and Oklahoma who are dealing with the aftermath of a tragic flood that literally swept people away. It's just been horrific to see the images. So I'm so sorry if that's you. And of course, another reason why we're talking about this topic. Finally, I'm going to answer a question on whether it's smart to spend the extra money to get your home listed on an MLS if you're selling your home yourself. FSBOs are more and more common, especially as the market heats up. There are fewer homes in competition. Homes are going for top dollar, even foreclosure. This is a great question, and I want to make sure that everybody understands how it works and what's at risk if you don't list your home with an MLS. Okay. That's this week's lineup. Let's get started. Today's daily update. Realty Track's foreclosure numbers came out last week, and so I asked Darren Bloomquist to come back on the show to help me break it down. He's the vice president at Realty Track and a frequent guest here on Big Money Real Estate. So let's talk foreclosures. Darren, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
All right, so what did the foreclosure numbers say this month?
Well, what they said is that while we are still on a downward trend, going back to normal levels of foreclosure activity, there was a spike in specifically bank repossessions, which is the final stage of foreclosure. We saw actually a pretty dramatic spike in bank repossessions a 27-month high.
Wow.
They were up 50% year over year in the month of March specifically.
So you're seeing the numbers were about, what, 126,000 properties in April that went into foreclosure or that were taken back?
Yeah, the 126,000 nearly properties, that's all foreclosure activity.
Okay.
If we look at just the ones that were repossessed by banks in April, that was over 45,000. And that's the number really that was up. The 45,000 was up 50% from a year ago. And up to a 27-month high. When we look at just foreclosure starts, those actually continued at around 50,000 new property starting foreclosure,
mm-hmm.
which is back to pre-crisis levels of foreclosure starts. So that's the good news. The bad news is we're still dealing with the cleanup in the form of these bank repossessions of the last housing crisis.
So the top four states on your study for these Florida, Nevada, Maryland, and New Jersey, I think Maryland and New Jersey are judicial states. This doesn't include states like Illinois and New York, where do you think that you could see these numbers continue to be high, these bank repossessions, simply because the New York hasn't really kicked in, Illinois hasn't really kicked in, or do you feel like we're now... we've moved beyond that and it'll kind of stay where it is for a few months and then go?
No, I think we'll see each state handles the foreclosure process, as you know, differently. And so I think we'll see these little mini waves of bank repossessions coming out, and the judicial states are most susceptible to that. So I won't be surprised to see some pops in the numbers in New York, places like New York and Illinois. And in fact, I mean, Illinois was number six in terms of foreclosure rate, and we did see a 46% increase in bank repossessions in Illinois specifically. It was just down a little bit further than some of those other markets, and New York also ranks very relatively low, number 22 in terms of overall foreclosure rate. But mm-hmm. if we center in on those bank repossessions, those are actually up 142% year over year.
Wow.
In New York. So we're definitely seeing this in the judicial states now. Just to put those numbers in context, especially in New York, we're coming off extremely low numbers last year because of the very lengthy, protracted foreclosure process. We weren't seeing a lot of bank repossessions last year. Now, finally, that the logjam is loosening, that number's coming up, and that percentage increase looks pretty dramatic, although we're actually not, you know, the foreclosure rate is not overwhelming in a place like New York.
So another telling number out of your pile of statistics that you got this month is the average sale price of an REO, real estate-owned property, that sold was 87% of the average estimated market value of those same properties at the time of sale. The price point of these REOs are moving significantly higher. Places like San Diego, and San Diego is 100%. It's mm-hmm. selling at full price. Charlotte is selling at full price. San Francisco, nearly full price. Bakersfield. It's really Portland, Oregon. I mean, all these places where REOs were amazing values, it's not like they're great values anymore in those areas.
That's right. I mean, from the buyer's perspective, if you're going in some of these markets and looking for an REO or a bank-owned home, even with this surge in bank repossessions that we saw in April, unfortunately, you're not going to probably get a great discount in some of these markets because there is such low inventory of overall homes for sale that even these distressed properties are experiencing very high demand and competition from other buyers, and that's pushing up the price point that they're actually selling for.
Yeah, I mean, it's really good to see this kind of market suction happen for everybody who's got an existing home. And there are pockets where this is... you know, seriously, looking at a state or a city, you really run the risk of kind of overemphasizing how something is doing, right? I mean, Atlanta saying that properties, REOs, are selling at 70% of what everything else is selling for. When you get into some of the outer boroughs of Atlanta, you are in a neighborhood where still there are a tremendous number of foreclosures and prices are very depressed there. And so that's balancing off with a place where it might be 100% of what's going
yeah.
on. So it's for anybody who's watching this, you want to keep in mind that it's so local, and we're talking about it on a regional or a citywide or a global level. It may not be the same in your neighborhood. You have to actually step on your front stoop and take a look around and see what's going on.
I think the takeaway is distressed properties, bank-owned properties can be great deals, but they're not guaranteed to be a great deals, especially in this market where there's such competition. So you just, you know, you have to really look at it as on an individual property-by-property basis if you're a buyer, and not assume just because it's a bank-owned property, it's a screaming deal.
When you look out, Darren, do you feel like we're at the end of the opportunity for investors?
Oh, no, certainly not. I don't think the end of the opportunity, but probably the end of kind of a very, very nice period for investors. And so we're coming to the end of this unique, fairly unique opportunity for investors when home prices were still probably overcorrected on the downside and were coming up rapidly.
Yeah.
And so we're moving back into a normal market, which still presents opportunities for investors, but not maybe the scope of opportunity that we had seen during 2012, 2013, even into the first half of 2014. Those are really the golden years in recent memory for real estate investors, and we're moving out of that.
Yeah, I would argue that you've had anybody who hasn't been paying attention to what I've been saying since 2008, and now we're 2015. You've had like 6.5 years to make this work, guys. If you haven't done it now, the good times are over. You're going to have to work harder for it. Darren, thank you so much for this. Will you come back tomorrow? I'd like to talk about the new residential sales numbers that just came out this week and get your take on what you see happening there.
Sure, I'd love to do that. Thank you.
All right. We will talk to you again shortly. And we are nearing the end of the really golden months for all of you who are looking for great REOs. But I wanted to continue our conversation about April's housing market activity by digging into the new construction numbers from the new report that came out this week. Darren, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks for having me again. Great to be on 2 days in a row.
I know. We love having you. So sales of new single-family houses in April of 2015, this April, were seasonally adjusted to be at 517,000. I think that this is the first time that we're seeing that seasonally adjusted annual rate over 500,000. I think it might even be the first time over 450,000 in maybe 7 or 8 years. And we're almost 7% above the revised March rate. The revised March rate went up to 484,000. We're 26% above where we were a year ago in April of 2014. And this is still about half of where I think we should be, which is sort of interesting. And I'm wondering, since the median sales price of new construction houses sold last month was almost $300,000 and the average price was $341,000, what do you think is going on here?
You know, I think we're finally seeing this increase that a lot of people have been expecting. Like, when are the home builders, and we see it in the housing start numbers, starting to build more homes? And we've seen that over the past year, and now they're finally starting to sell more homes. And so this is a really good sign for the most part that the home builders are confident that the housing market has returned to a more stable, predictable level. And then on the other side of the coin, the buyers are also more comfortable that they can buy in this market a new home at a higher price point than they would get an existing home for. And they're confident that that home is not going to hit a bubble and decrease in value. And so I think on both sides, the builders and the buyers are gaining confidence. And this really demonstrates that. And it's something we've been expecting for some time to see this kind of pop in those numbers.
So here's my concern. If new houses are selling for roughly 300,000, it's about 297,000 and change. Excuse me. If it's selling for $300,000, you really have to be earning almost $100,000 a year, maybe $80,000, $85,000 if you really stretch it and you have enough of a down payment. You've got to be earning serious bucks. It's well above what the median income is in this country, which is still about $52,000 for a family of four. So the number of people that it's not that a number of people don't earn $100,000. It's just that family income, that's on the high side. And so it seems like, since this is a median number, so the same number of homes sold for below that price as above that price, we're seeing the number of higher priced homes sell whereas the number of lower-priced to mid-priced homes, not so much.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's a valid concern to look at that affordability factor. But I think what you have here with the buyers is there's pent-up demand from buyers who have regained equity in their homes. We're starting to definitely see that when we look at home equity numbers. There's now 11 million homeowners nationwide who have over 50% equity. And
wow.
That's, I'm not misspeaking that, over 50% equity in their homes. And meanwhile, you do still have 7 million people who are stuck underwater, but those 11 million folks are the target for these home builders. They've regained and gained a lot of equity in their homes, and they now, I think, are starting to leverage that equity into becoming new home buyers, and they can use some of that equity for the down payment on these higher priced homes. And then you also have the influence of foreign buyers, which is a little bit harder to measure, but they're coming in and willing to buy these homes at a higher price point. And that is, while affordability is definitely a concern from a perspective of income, you do have these buyers who aren't as dependent on income who are coming in and snatching up some of these properties, I believe.
I think it's going to be interesting to see what's happening. Like, I look in New York, and there are buildings that are selling where I think the cheapest unit in the building is $15 or $20 million. And some of those buildings have started to turn over, and while that's only 30 or 40 units, it does count in this total number. And there are a number of those kinds of trophy buildings that are going up in New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, to a lesser extent in Chicago and Boston, down in Miami, where you are seeing a tremendous number of Latin Americans with huge amounts of cash coming in. And it's kind of interesting to just think about how that skews numbers just a little bit. And so maybe what we are seeing is a fair number of these houses go in at $2,250, which would be much more affordable to a family with income of $75,000, say, at today's interest rates, versus, you know, something that's a little bit higher than normal. When you look at the numbers that you have at Realty Track, I know that you feel good about this number, and certainly I think the more new houses that we can get built, the better it is, and certainly the supply of homes, which is less than 5 months at the current sales rate, it's not all that much. What else are you hearing about sort of new construction that would impact your customers?
Well, yeah, I think this is a good number, but I think that it's very good that we're seeing evidence that this is kind of a number that everybody's been expecting for so long, is to me evidence that the builders are being very cautious and very selective about where they're building and looking at data much more closely. And I think that's a good thing. I definitely think it's better for them to be erring on the side of caution. With this recent, we do believe there's still some shadow inventory caught up in the system that hasn't come out from the housing crisis. And there's evidence of that in our latest foreclosure report, which does show this surge in bank repossessions. And so the home builders are right to be cautious and know that in some areas there's still some of that shadow inventory that they will have to compete against. Maybe not so much with the foreign investor who has lots of cash, but with the more traditional buyer who's coming into the market and weighing the option of buying a new home versus an existing home.
Yeah.
We are seeing evidence there's more inventory on the existing side, especially when it comes to the distressed market. So caution, I think, is still the word of the day. And also an understanding that this foreign buyer is going to behave differently than your regular buyer in the past. And so you want to take that into account and think about, you know, how long of an owner? Are they in this for the long term, for 10, 20, 30 years? Or is this just an investment that they may turn around and want to sell in the near future?
I keep hearing that a lot of these foreign investors aren't even moving into these buildings. Or if they are, they completely outfit them, and then they spend 1 week a year there, which is crazy to me.
Yeah, well, it's purely, in some cases, I think, an investment for them, a place to park their cash. And so as it's not necessarily going to be when something changes for them financially, they may want to sell that right away and very quickly. And I think that's created a little bit of a false sense of low inventory in this market when those buyers are snatching up so many properties, especially, and I think trophy properties is a great way to say it, in some of these markets like New York and Miami, and we see it out here in Los Angeles as well.
All right, well, great insight as always. Thank you so much. Darren Blomquist is Vice President at Realty Track. Today, I'd like to talk a little bit about insurance, and not your average insurance policy. I want to talk about specialized insurance. I got a comment on our Twitter feed asking me to discuss specialized hurricane coverage in Florida, which can be extremely expensive and confusing to purchase, but it can also be critical, especially if you live on the Gulf Coast, just like earthquake insurance or wildfire insurance can be a smart, if expensive, bet if you live in certain parts of California. My guest today is Mary Comerio, and she has extensive knowledge about specialized insurance policies. She's a professor of the Graduate School at UC Berkeley's Department of Architecture, and she's written and researched extensively on the topic of natural disaster loss mitigation. Mary, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Good morning.
Good morning. So we are now officially, well, as of June 1st, in the season of crazy weather. Not like we haven't had crazy weather, but we've got hurricanes on the horizon. Over the weekend, disastrous amounts of flooding across Oklahoma and Texas. I mean, people washed away. It's just horrible, horrible stories. And yet many communities are still not participating in with the National Flood Insurance Program because local governments are unwilling to adopt any developmental regulations. In California and Florida, we've got private insurers that don't even want to offer earthquake or hurricane insurance anymore. Why don't you give us an update on where you see things right now?
Well, right now, it's difficult. It's difficult for homeowners. It's difficult for real estate investors. Disaster insurance, the insurance industry in general, has realized how big their risks are in this. It wasn't something that just happens once in a great while, but we're seeing more and more disasters globally. And that pattern has meant that they're a little nervous about offering policies. So the policies are getting more expensive and more difficult to get. And in some states, you can't even get them, like California, Florida, and Hawaii. You mostly buy earthquake or hurricane insurance through a kind of quasi-governmental organization.
So without the ability to buy private insurance policies, how are homeowners going to cope with something like in New Orleans, when you didn't really have, it wasn't really the hurricane that did New Orleans in, it was complete failure of the technology that was protecting the lower Ninth Ward. How do you protect yourself in an era where sort of big insurance companies don't even think that they can offload to reinsurance companies some of this risk?
Well, it really varies community to community. I mean, for most of the East, flood insurance is available, although, as you say, there are some jurisdictions that don't participate, some local jurisdictions. But you can get it. It's simply you can get the insurance. It's just expensive. And so I have these three rules about, you know, how you decide whether or not to buy this insurance. The first is, what is your risk? Whether it's earthquakes, how close you are to the fault, what are your soil conditions, hurricanes, where are you on the coast? Are you, you know, in a flood zone, et cetera? Second, what's the condition of your building? What's the condition of your house, if it's a house? Is it up to modern, contemporary, and I mean like codes in the last 5 years, not built in 1960s modern, because 1960s modern doesn't do you a whole lot of good. Mm-hmm. You know, does it have hurricane clips? Is it bolted to the foundation for earthquakes? Those kinds of questions. And third, you know, who owns more, you or the bank? Are you really willing to walk away from this investment? Or are you willing to have some savings that it's going to take for the amount of the deductible to do repairs that are necessary? So those are the kinds of things I think people need to think about. And if you're in a high-risk zone, you need to bite the bullet and buy the insurance.
So what are some prices that, or the way that you see the growth of prices? Because some of the research that we've done for some of our clients shows that disaster coverage, not disaster coverage, but the cost of disasters has risen almost tenfold in the last 10 or 15 years. That's far above any sort of rate of inflation that anybody can imagine. So you're looking at disasters that are costing billions of dollars to fix. It seems as though that will be unaffordable, the kind of policies that you would require as an individual owner or even as a real estate investor, that those just might be unaffordable. You're simply willing to take, you have to be willing to take a risk at that point in time and say, I don't really have $20,000 a year to put towards hurricane insurance, or I don't have $20,000 a year to put towards earthquake insurance. I'm going to self-insure. So how do you make that kind of judgment call?
Well, I think it's a combination of both understanding the risk, understanding when a property is not a good idea. You know, maybe you shouldn't be investing there. I mean, that's part of it. You know, is this too high risk a property for your investment profile? Just like some stocks and bonds are too high risk for certain investors. There are properties that are too high risk. And then I think you decide between the mitigation question, you know, how much do I do? I live in probably, you know, in the Bay Area, living in San Francisco, I'm the furthest from both faults where my house is, Hayward and San Andreas. I'm 10 kilometers each away from each of them. So I'm, you know, that's as far as you can get in the Bay Area away
yes.
from a major fault. I'm on solid rock, and I've spent a lot of money on my seismic upgrading of my old house. So I'm pretty convinced that I don't need insurance because I can afford to take care of it. But not everybody, you know, somebody who lives right on the fault line in a slide zone, they need insurance.
Right. And I do believe that insurance is so incredibly helpful. Now, I understand that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration has advocated establishing disaster-resistant communities. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I think this is a movement that has started really in California, but has grown in a lot of other places. The idea is that the whole community, the city, the jurisdiction, the region, is looking at, you know, the kinds of things that they can do to make them more resilient. So some of that is, you know, investing in redundant water lines or gas line shutoffs or, you know, improvements in infrastructure. In California, we've retrofitted every bridge in the state of California. So we don't expect our bridges to collapse in an earthquake. But it also is about targeting specific subsets of buildings within the community that the community thinks are really important. For San Francisco, that's housing, because housing, it's a dense city. We're surrounded by water on three sides, connected by bridges. If you lose housing, people leave. So we're really focused on retrofitting some highly vulnerable kinds of building types that house a lot of people, large apartment buildings. And that's a citywide goal. And there are laws and regulations. There are some financial assistance. So it's a combination of carrot and stick policies. Los Angeles is looking at a similar kind of approach right now, where they're focusing on both public infrastructure and certain very vulnerable building types. And I think that this is a common approach so that you lessen your potential for loss before the earthquake or hurricane or tornado or whatever happens.
So one final question, because this is, I know, coming up every week or so, I see some sort of new study that says that the polar ice caps are melting, the oceans are rising, and, you know, coastal communities are in danger. I think about New York as a place where we have seen, you know, the rise and the flooding start to really encroach, depending on what happens with different kinds of hurricanes and storm surges. But there's some real concern that New York City, unless they dam up the river somehow, New York City could be at tremendous risk. You know, have you been reading about how to make, you know, what is the thinking around making New York a disaster-resistant community?
Well, actually, New York is doing a fantastic job post-Sandy. They have invested a huge amount in the water's edge infrastructure in order to make areas both be, you know, parks and recreation areas, but also places that can take flooding or sea level rise when that happens. And they're doing a really great job on that work. And around the whole edge of Manhattan and the other boroughs. I mean, there's been a huge amount of progress in terms of the planning and the beginning of the implementations on that. I think, you know, we have the same issues in Florida. We have the same issues all along the Eastern Seaboard. So it's not just New York. I mean, New York's a big city, but
big
it's
city,
not just
a lot of people live there.
A lot of people live there. A lot of people live, though, in Florida as well, and right on the water. So those are going to be that kind of planning. There's a lot of examples in Europe, especially in, the places where they're used to floods all the time, Northern Europe. So there's a lot of experience with this out there in the world. And I think a lot of good examples to follow. And New York really jumped on the bandwagon and has been doing a lot of that work.
Well, it's really interesting, and I really appreciate you coming on the show today to talk a little bit about this, Mary.
Well, my pleasure.
Mary Camerio is an architecture professor at the University of California at Berkeley. If you decide to sell your home without a real estate agent, you should consider using a multiple listing service. Someone asked me about using a for sale by owner website to sell a home after getting kind of fed up with a real estate agent. And I said, that's fine. I have often recommended using FSBO sites, but there's a difference in what happens and what you have to do. This particular person noticed a big difference in the price for websites that included a listing on the MLS, right, multiple listing service for 6 months, and versus just sort of doing it on your own and having it just be in this FSBO kind of listing service. He wondered if an MLS listing is really necessary. Here's what I think about MLSs. There are all kinds of statistics out there that indicate that most homes sell with the help of a real estate agent, right? It's probably 85%, somewhere between 85 and 92% of all homes are going to sell with the help of a real estate agent. Not all of those agents will belong to a multiple listing service. But the number one tool to market those homes is probably the MLS, and the vast majority of agents you're going to work with are realtors. Realtors belong to the local MLS. In most markets, the MLS gives real estate agents the ability to view and review all listings in a geographic area at certain price points. Some industry observers say that if your home isn't on the MLS, you're actually losing out on the single most effective tool to sell your house. 20 years ago, a FSBO seller would advertise a home in local newspapers and basically stick a lawn sign in the yard. Few, if any, of these FSBO sellers succeeded in selling their homes, and if they did, it took a while because it was really hard to find, right? You'd have to actually open up the local newspaper that particular day, or you'd have to drive by the property and see the sign. More recently, the internet has started to level the playing field, which is great, and there are a lot of different options other than hiring a full-service real estate agent. But many buyers still work with real estate agents full-service on the purchase side. And those buyer agents rely on the MLS to show them quickly and easily what homes are available. Now, you can go to places like Zillow, and there are other kinds of for sale by owner, FSBO sites. And buyers will often do this work ahead of time and then present a list of available properties they want to see to the agent. What does the agent do? The agent then goes back to the MLS to find out which ones are actually available and who's offering what kind of commission. If many or most buyers work with real estate agents that use the MLS, right, a FSBO seller could potentially lose access to a large percentage of buyers looking for homes out there, which is why most FSBO sellers try to find a way to get their homes onto the local MLS. The FSBO services that you see in a package can assist you with this, right? And they will often have that MLS available. They're charging you just a little bit more than what they get charged by the MLS to list the properties. You'll want to give your home the greatest exposure to the biggest number of buyers. So you're not going to want to exclude a major source of potential buyers when marketing your home, hence why most people go MLS. Make sure you understand what it's going to take to sell your home. Don't overprice it, because just trying to sell it yourself already is a big step. And then if you overprice it, you're not going to really have a good result. You've got to make sure that your home shows really well inside and out. Take beautiful digital photos to post on all kinds of websites, from Zillow to your own website to Craigslist, wherever it is. You could create a beautiful brochure virtually, or you can print it out. You can make sure that the description of your home is interesting and succinct and emphasizes the strengths, and of course, be as accurate as possible. As the real estate market has improved in many areas, I think that everybody has a better chance of selling their home today on their own than you might have had a year or two ago, right? But remember, when you're a FSBO, you take on the role of the agent as well as the role of the seller, and that's a lot for any one person. It's easy to make a mistake, and then your house is just going to sit there month in, month out, and everybody else's market house is going to sell in the market. So you have to decide if you've got what it takes and you're willing to make the choices you need to make to actually sell on your own. So having said all that, if you list your house on your own, right, as a FSBO, and you haven't sold in 3 to 6 weeks, I think you should consider putting your house into the MLS and probably hiring a real estate agent. Because unless you get super lucky at that point, you've already attracted all the attention that you're going to attract, and you'll probably wait a lot longer for the right buyer to come along than you want to. And after all, you're only listing your house for sale because it's time to move on with your life. There are a number of things to keep in mind when you buy a vacation home as an investment. So if you use the home for more than 14 days a year, or it's not rented that much, the home might be considered a second home for tax purposes and not an investment rental. And that's pretty important. Owning a vacation investment property that's rented all the time will give you income to report to the IRS, plus you'll have deductions from the expenses of owning the property, including real estate taxes, homeowner dues, management fees, upkeep, and other kinds of costs and expenses. How you deal with the tax situation could be complicated, and you probably are going to want to talk to your accountant or tax preparer and learn more about how vacation rentals may affect your federal income taxes, not to mention state income taxes, before moving forward with this particular type of investment. Then there are the many issues that go along with becoming a landlord or investment property owner of vacation property. If you rent out the property for months at a time, you'll only have to deal with one renter and then find another. But if you have a vacation rental property where you'll see dozens and dozens of people staying at the home through the year, you'll need a reliable team to help you manage tasks from meeting short-term guests at the property, showing them around, to inspecting the home each time your guests leave, to getting the home cleaned up, to written agreements, damage deposits, receiving payments, refunding deposits, fielding calls, maintaining the property, cleaning the property. Oh, I said that already. Replacing the linens and upgrading just general wear and tear are among the many items that you're going to have to take care of. And you're going to want, as I said, a team to help you do that. Vacation rentals are often part of a pool of rental properties in large developments. So in many cases, you'd only receive a fraction of the amount of the rental, and the management company is going to keep the rest. Could be even as much as 50-60% that goes to the management company. Now, the management company takes care of the maintenance issues surrounding the home, and they're going to meet your guests and take care of the keys and blah, blah, blah. But you're still going to be the one to write the check when you have to take care of the property and replace the pillows and replace the couches and recover fabric, whatever it is. Years ago, I knew a couple that owned a property in the mountains of New England, and they had successfully rented it out for a number of years using a management company. One year, they went to visit the property, and they found that the artwork in the rental unit had been stolen, all of it, really cool stuff. They didn't know when the theft had occurred, and dozens of people had stayed in the rental since the prior visit, and the management company apparently never really checked the boxes on this, and they declined all responsibility. So this family had to rely on whatever they got from their insurance company. You have to be vigilant when owning a vacation rental. You're going to need to go over the numbers with your estimates of how many days a year you expect the home to be rented, and what the expectation is of what the costs are going to be, and always count on it being more than you think. If you use a management company, please factor in those costs as well. Now, after you run the numbers, you can decide if this is actually a good investment for you compared with other investment opportunities, and think about, again, how much time you're going to have to spend taking care of all of these issues that are involved with a vacation rental. As always, consider the exit strategy, right? You've got to buy in a location that's stable and growing, where sales occur frequently, and where you feel in the future you will not have difficulty letting go of this property if and when you need to. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and as always, I want to give a big thank you to my guests for their time and their expertise. If there was anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com. That's thinklink.com. Also, if you're new to the show, please subscribe. And if you're a regular listener and haven't already done so, please consider giving the show a rating or review on iTunes. And you can do that by searching for The Elyse Kling Show in the podcast section of iTunes. This helps the show get discovered by new people. This brings us to the end of another episode of The Elyse Kling Show. I'm still your host, Elyse Kling, and I'll be back with a new episode again next week. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you then.